Hi there, friends. Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and this is Internet Talk Radio, broadcasted from Sweden, Scandinavia. On Thursdays and Sundays, we are here highlighting information and research for your consideration. We do not tell you what or how to think, or what you should or shouldn't believe. We try to lay forth the information in the best way we can and help to highlight the research of various authors, filmmakers and researchers, and to bring their information to your attention. And we don't claim that we are presenting or that we know the truth, but we are searching for it, and we are trying to find out what is going on now, what has been going on in the past, and what we might expect in the future. We think you should make up your own mind about these subjects that we cover and continue the search for yourself if you find it interesting. Dare to explore the world and consequently yourself. And I'm glad that you tuned in today for those of you who are interested in catastrophism, the restart of civilization, origins of agriculture, farming, the Sumerian connection, everything from religion and mythology and even the Garden of Eden. This is going to be a really interesting program. Our guest today is researcher and lecturer Edmund Merridge. He has continued and picked up on the research of a Christian O'Brien that we're going to talk more about in the program. Christian O'Brien is no longer with us. He wrote extensively on why, how, and where human civilization popped up, so to speak, or restarted, rather, and the connection to the global catastrophe and the Shining Ones, among many other topics. Edmund Merridge website is goldenageproject.org.uk. Again, that's goldenageproject.org.uk. Go over there and take a good look around. You can find links to Edmund's video lectures. And on the website, you can also find DVDs, articles, and books by Christian and his wife, Barbara Joy O'Brien. Also, before we bring on our guest here, I just want to mention at the beginning that our good friend and guest, Daniel Tatman, helped us to get in contact with Edmund. So thanks for hooking us up, Dan. Cheers, mate. So with that, let's say welcome to our guest, Edmund Merridge. Thank you very much for joining us today. It's a pleasure having you on, sir.
Thank you, Henry.
I'm very glad you're here. I'm really excited about this program. We have so much to talk about. Let's begin just briefly, if you can. Tell us a little bit about yourself and the connection to Christian O'Brien and how kind of you got involved in some of his research and how you kind of continued the process of the research.
Well, Christian O'Brien was a part of my family, having married my mother's first cousin. And I knew he was a man of very high caliber in my few dealings I had with him. And when he retired in 1970 from a very successful career in the oil industry, I knew he was doing something exciting. He wouldn't say much about it. He was a very modest man in that respect. But it later became clear that he was spending all his time studying ancient civilizations, ancient languages. And what triggered the real momentum for him was in looking at monuments, stone megaliths and structures all over the country, but in particular where he lived near Thaxted in Essex. And he identified something which we now call Line A, which is a line of markers precisely at one megalithic mile apart, the Tom megalithic mile, which ran for 26 megalithic miles from Hatfield Forest in Essex to Wandlebury in Cambridgeshire. And Line A was slightly curved, and when he did all his calculations and checked everything out, he could see that the ancient surveyors who had established that line had actually curved it to the same extent that the meridian of the earth is curved, because the earth, of course, is a circular object.
Yes.
And therefore, the people who built that structure in 2,500 BC had precise knowledge of the earth's dimensions.
Hmm.
And the remainder of his work was to follow up and look at Bodmin Moor, where there was a vast observational and astronomy complex. And he worked in parallel, really, to people like Alexander Thom, other great revolutionary characters who decided that there was a strong possibility that all these ancient structures were far more sophisticated and used for observational astronomy. And he went off then to look for these people, where they could have come from, and trace them back to the land of Canaan and Sumer. And it became necessary for him to learn these ancient languages, Hebrew, look at the cuneiform tablets. And he tracked them down and found out who these people were and opened up the whole history from the time of 2,500 BC right the way back to the start of agriculture and civilization, which he located in southern Lebanon, 8 miles north of Mount Hermon and 25 miles west of Damascus.
That's fascinating. It's very, very precise. And this is, of course, what we're going to get into here today and talk about some of the evidence and surrounding ideas and theories about this. And I guess that you, of course, at this point with the Golden Age Project are working to spread the message, and you're doing a little bit of writing yourself. You're doing lectures and so forth, and helping to spread Christian O'Brien's work. Is that correct?
Yes, I actually rang Christian O'Brien and to ask him specifically, and I hadn't seen him for several years, and I really rang to find out about where the concept of vegetarianism comes from, because I was very much involved in agriculture and agricultural history and what was happening in our agricultural industry, not only in this country, but around the world. And that still is a speciality, if you like, agriculture and wildlife management. And when I spoke to him, he said, "Oh, I've just finished the book. It was a 10-year project. I've just finished it. I'm only printing 3 copies. You can have the proof to look at." And he posted me the proof. And when I looked at the proof of this book, which is called The Shining Ones, you can imagine how excited I was. And I went to see him. And it seemed to me absolutely crucial that other people knew about the work he'd done. But he'd been so disappointed, despite his CBE and all his great success in the oil industry, he found that he was being shunned by the archaeological establishment. And despite having produced marvelously scholarly work, he just didn't make any progress with people who are supposed to be doing this work.
Yes.
And he left him very disappointed, and he was too big a man to worry too much. He said, "Well, I'm happy. I've satisfied myself what it's all about." And I took up a challenge and persuaded he and Barbara Joy to republish The Genius of the Few, and also republish or publish 100 copies of The Shining Ones.
Fascinating. And his CBE, that's the Order of the British Empire. Did he get that from his work through his background in the oil industry? Is that correct?
That's right. He started off as an exploration geologist from Cambridge in 1936 and worked his way up to the head of the oil operating companies in Iran, which, because they were nationalized by Mossadegh. And his job was to manage all the oil interests, all the different oil companies around the world, to try and keep oil production going in Iran and to hand over the industry to the new, if you like, state of Iran after the Shah had been deposed. And it was his job, success in doing that, that he got his CBE.
That's interesting. And so, I mean, I guess he was a little bit familiar with the Middle Eastern region, so to speak, a little bit of the ancient lands down there, Persia, you know, stretching into the Middle East and so forth.
That's right. He said that he wanted a job somewhere near mountains. He loved mountains and loved climbing. And he decided to be an exploration geologist. And that took him out by sea and then by the company bus through the Lebanon to Syria, down to the Abadan refinery and the whole operation at Abadan by the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. And he was right in the Mesopotamian plains. And literally within the first month, he went out with a wonderful French geologist called Beaulieu. And Beaulieu knew about this extraordinary mound, which they went to look at and camp by. And as the sun was setting, they went up to the top of this mound and could see the shadows right the way through to the Zagros Mountains over the plains, where there were clearly field systems, and the setting sun showed up all these field systems very clearly. And on the mound they were actually standing on was had a number of clay tablets, and they were great, very excited by this, and they reported it to a French archaeological mission near Susa, not far away. And that ended up by being the discovery of a Dur Untush ziggurat, which was the city or king of Dur Untush, had built 1800 BC or before. And so that sparked off his interest in the extraordinary history of Sumer and the area of Mesopotamia, which really only became known as an ancient area of importance, something like 1850. And the exciting part about that was that so much of the records which were translated and looked at confirmed so much of what had been written in the Bible. And it then becomes clear that the Hebrew Bible takes a very large part of its material from the Sumerian records, yes, very much earlier dates.
Yes, and we are going to go through this chronologically today. Before the restart of civilization, we're going to backtrack to before that point and actually discuss the age of catastrophe. And let us start right there then and tell us a little bit about this. Where and what can we say happened to planet Earth at this point before the restart of the civilization?
Well, I'm still going to start in Sumeria with the fantastic collection of tablets by Ashurbanipal and his 7th century BC palace, which is accredited to Sargon near Nineveh. And he pulled together and collected all the tablets he could find and built up a great library of past material. And the Assyrians were the people who knew exactly who their gods were and had images of what we call the Abkarlu or the genie, which are now in the British Museum in the Assyrian room. And they wrote their history on the front of these plaques, which were always in the most important rooms, the throne rooms. And they accredited their history to these people. And alongside that information, we have all the material which we see Zechariah Sitchin bringing into his books about Tiamat and the whole complex astronomy which the so-called Chaldeans and the Sumerians had very clear records. And one of those records, the story of Tiamat, is used by Allen and Dallaire in their story about catastrophe, because what they're saying is that the Sumerians left us very detailed records of the cause of this great catastrophe round about, let's say, 10,500 BC. And they also knew that it was a star that had exploded, which means a supernova in modern language.
Yes.
A supernova had exploded. And we find from Richard Firestone's book, The Cycle of Cosmic Catastrophe, we find that if a supernova explosion had taken place in our galaxy or on close or a nearby galaxy, then there would have been three stages. First of all, a massive flash, which would have burnt everything on one side of the planet in the line of fire, so to speak.
Yes.
Then would have been maybe several thousand years later a shockwave, and then eventually we would have had the debris from that massive explosion coming into our particular planetary system. And the Sumerian suggestion is that Tiamat was part of the debris that came in through our solar system and our planets and caused absolute havoc and hammered into the Earth multiple objects, clouds of gas, which was at not superheated, but super cooled gas, which suddenly gave us the most appalling conditions, rippled the surface of the Earth and tipped the Earth on its axis. So we have really amongst that material, which Sitchin used in a different way, we have a record of a very recent major catastrophe, which explains the story of the Great Flood, if you like. Noah was a king in southern Sumer, and it looks as though his flood was a flood round about 4250 BC, which was what we call the climatic optimum, the highest temperatures reached in that Holocene period, the wholly recent period.
Yes.
And so we have people like Plato talking and Solon going to Egypt and being told by Sonchus that there were many floods and many diverse movements of stars and objects. And if we piece this jigsaw puzzle together, as people have done and are now doing, we're beginning to build up a clearer profile all the time of what has happened. And I hope we'll be able to fill all the pieces in together to get a very clear picture of our incredible ancestors and what they actually had to go through, and how a small group of survivors started all over again, and we've been surviving on their knowledge and their success for 10,000 years.
This is fascinating, and we got to clarify at this point also that O'Brien then was one of these scholars who were reading cuneiform and knew the language, right? And he had a kind of, as you mentioned a little bit there, a different interpretation than the majority, so to speak, will be familiar, and that will be the kind of Sitchin version of the story, so to speak.
That's right. He found that Professor George Barton, who was a wonderful man, but he was conditioned by religion and like us all, found themselves in a religious straitjacket because we're not exactly brainwashed, but we are taught in a certain way, depending on our family or whatever,
yes,
either as Islam or Jewish or whatever. And the problem with Professor George Barton, he looked at these records and thought that they were incantations and hymns. Well, they weren't incantations and hymns. They were extremely sensible, practical, straightforward records of what had happened to practical people. Now, Abraham was a very practical person. He had to deliver discoveries of oil. He had to rewrite geology books. He wrote a book which gave great detail on how far the Rocky Mountains had moved over the last 40 million years, which was crucial to find out where oil was and where the drilling should take place.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when he met Barbara Joy O'Brien's father, whom I call my Uncle Pat, Uncle Pat said, as he would to any young man, although Christian Abraham was about 40 at that time, he said, "What do you do, young man?" And he said, "I'm working out how far the Rocky Mountains have moved in the last 30 million years." And of course, he had been doing that. And it was that kind of skill. But what he did, which was special, and this is a point that all good cuneiform translators now realize, is that you have to go back to what we now know as the original Indo-European picture and symbol language, which evolved from pictures into the cuneiform. It also evolved into the Egyptian hieroglyphs and the Indus Valley script and the other scripts we find all around the world, the talking board scripts.
Yes.
So there was a common picture language, a spatial, very good spatial memory. People are very good at it. If I want to come and drive to Sweden, I can find the same arrows and signs in France and England as I find in Sweden. These are the spatial things which,
yes,
we're very good at doing.
Yes.
And so the ordinary people were given the spatial language. But back to good old Ashburnapal in his library, he said that he could read the language from before the flood. Now, what he was talking about was the alphabetic text, which was always in-house to the kings and the advisors to kings and was taught at the kingship schools. So when Ashburnapal, who was a candidate for kingship, he'd been selected as a bright young man who would be a good king, because that's the way they did it then, he, in fact, had learnt at the kingship school the alphabeg or alphabetic text, which went back several thousand, many thousand years, probably to very early times. And that was the in-house writing and symbol, which we find the Druids using in-house, but they didn't shout about it, so to speak. And so it's very important for people to realize that the picture and symbol language was for the ordinary people, and that in-house they always had a speedy writing, as it's described by Enoch, which was the alphabetic text.
Mm.
And one of the difficulties here is that the Hebrew and the Aramaic never made use of the vowels. They could have done, and they should have done, but they produced a codified version of the Phoenician alphabet. And that codified version has been incredibly difficult to translate through what is called parasynonymia, which means that the meaning of a word or a phrase, you have to know what it's all about to be able to correctly translate it. So you have maybe six different translations, depending on the context in which maybe four or five words are used.
Uh-huh. Mm.
And this has led to so much difficulty. We have to get away from the Hebrew and Aramaic if we want to really know what went on,
mm,
and move back to the Egyptian and move back to the cuneiform. And in order for O'Brien to accurately translate these texts, he had to start with the picture language, which the scribes had turned on its side and then stylized in their own particular way. So it became necessary to employ a scribe to tell you what was going on.
That's interesting. And, you know, so let's talk a little bit about some of the stories and the context here on what they were talking about. We know at this point then that according to this, there was big catastrophe. We can see evidence of this. We don't have time in this program right now to go into all of the physical evidence. There are, you know, numerous things that we can look at upon the Earth itself that obviously supports this theory. But let's look at the stories here, the storytelling, the mythology, if you will, of this. And so we know that there was a great catastrophe, and then we have a handful, you can tell us here how many, of course, but we have a few survivors from this time. We have a few survivors that were keeping this knowledge alive, so to speak, and consequently was teaching the other people about their knowledge. Tell us a little bit about these and who these survivors were.
The best evidence now is that at that time, it was the largest mass extinction for 3.5 million years. We had giant horses, we had saber-toothed tigers, we have rhinoceros, we have so many different types of elephants in the Americas, horses in the Americas. The record is absolutely extraordinary, and that is one of the marvelous jobs that Allen and Dallaire have done in their book, Catastrophe. So we know it was absolutely horrifying, and the whole earth was crumpled and moved, and we find that the Rift Valley, which runs from Turkey down to Malawi and nearly into South Africa, and the Great Rift Valley, the Alps, the Himalayas, the Tibetan Plateau, all were moved either sideways or upwards. And at the same time, we have many parts of the world sinking by enormous amounts. I thought that 2,000 feet looked crazily large, but then Allen and Dallaire are talking about massive movements vertically of the Earth's crust in the region of New Zealand, which are almost unbelievable. And we had a major sea in the middle of the Sahara, much of Siberia, the Black Sea, and the Caspian Sea, right to the Aral Sea, was one great big sea. And the way in which our planet looks was totally different to the way it looks now. And I advise anybody to just look at this geological record. We have so much debris washed into caves, which includes human bones, animal bones, trees, organic material of all kinds. And it was something which is just very difficult to describe. Somehow, a group of people, and we have stories right through North America, South America, and other parts of the world, of the god or the creator god or the senior people around had told the ordinary people or the tribal people, whatever, go dig a hole, cover it with logs and earth and hide because we're going to have a big problem. And presumably the people who were able to pass that message around the planet had very good facilities themselves, like a massive platform which they could go under, which was going to be dry, where they were extremely well protected. And rooms and stonework, etc., reminiscent of the Baalbek platform, the Mount Moriah platform in Jerusalem, the Persepolis platform, and many other platform structures around the world, which are on that archaeological record, but perhaps not noticed for what they really are. We also remember much later times, we have the construction of dolmen and megaliths of all kinds. And even in Turin's, in the area of the Aegean Sea, we find megarons, which are internal rooms, which are safe places to go when the sky is falling or when cometary debris is coming into the system.
Yes.
Much the same as every a house in Switzerland, I think, is under obligation to have a cellar or a building which does the job of an A-bomb shelter now.
Mm.
So we have to rethink and reassess the fact that much of the early these structures were to protect people, rather like Anderson shelters in the war, we call them in Britain. But certainly people had to reconstruct something that worked like a cave and had good drainage for what the solar system was throwing at us.
So
out of all that, we find a small group of survivors, seven archangels, as they're called, Anu and Enlil, and we can identify amongst them An as a single leader of the Anunnaki. And the Anunnaki is a word we've used Anunnaki, in fact, by the archaeologists in Sumer. It isn't a Sitchin invention. And we've got to be able to look and realize that An or Anu, An was the senior Sumerian god. They knew exactly who their god was. And we have An and Enlil and Ninkar Sag, who was the governor of the Garden of Eden, the bright spark, the lady biologist who worked with Enki, who was Enlil's brother. And we get back to that story, which matches the similar stories that Zechariah Sitchin is talking about. And Zechariah Sitchin has played a major role, a helpful role, I think. And he was, you know, to a certain extent, having to work on all this material. And we really owe a great debt to him in what he has done, even though perhaps some of us may feel that over time, the new evidence that we have means that much of his material needs looking at again.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, one thing we can mention here right away also is, or discuss a little bit about that, is where these come from, of course. I mean, Sitchin takes this off planet, but as I understand it from your research and or consequently also O'Brien's research, then that we don't have to go off planet to describe these seven archangels, as you said. Tell us a little bit about what you believe, they came from first, so to speak.
Well, with a catastrophe of this size and a supernova explosion, it's pretty clear that the whole of our galaxy, which centers on the Milky Way, our galaxy, and planets in our system would have been dramatically affected by this enormous catastrophe. It may be that Mars lost its atmosphere around the same time. It would be probable that all the other structures in our galaxy would have been very seriously affected. And if there was life on other planets in our galaxy or neighboring galaxies, then there is always a suggestion here that those people may have had to consider starting again. But I think one of the major clues is what we know about our atmosphere. We know that a large chunk of the Earth's atmosphere was destroyed at this point in time. We have these extraordinarily large animals on the fossil record. And the research, which I understand is being undertaken now, particularly in water tanks, where you can recreate an atmospheric conditions, which we had at the end of the Ice Age, they're finding that they are able to, species we know well, are growing to twice their normal size and living twice as long in a more dense atmosphere. That is a clue. When we hear about giants or tall people, that is a clue that some of our species, Homo sapiens sapiens, were larger than us. We talk about Cro-Magnon being 6 feet, 6 foot six, but we've also got a lot of evidence of people being much taller than that. And an explanation for that is that they were part of these survivors, the bloodlines, if you like, genetics of people who had lived through a planet which had a much denser atmosphere. And I think this kind of science and research is going to give us a much better clue as to who these people were and where they came from.
Yes.
And I think that common sense tells us that it's far more likely that they would have been from this planet than any other planet.
And this is, I mean, this is really fascinating, because what you're saying here is that the circumstances of what was potentially so different on Earth back then. We had a more lush planet, more oxygen in the atmosphere, as you said, and so we might have ending up here with a small fraction of people that are the original inhabitants of this planet. Very few survived this, And of course, what immediately arises here is two different branches, so to speak, of the story. One is that we have this kind of biblical narrative of this, also, of course, of the giants or the Nephilim, as some call them. They have been called the Shining Ones as well in other circles. And that's one, you know, factor that we can take into account here. And then the other account is, of course, where do we come from in all of this? Because if we weren't around back then, but we were around you know, early enough, so to speak, in order to write about them and these still these people that are still were left, you know. So tell us a little bit about this and what you think here happened.
Well, I'm very influenced by our geneticists, and I'm hoping that Mark Thomas, who's one of the people I most respect on genetic work, who's based at UCL, I'm hoping he's going to come and talk to us at our Stars and Stones Winter Forum in November the 16th, and 15th and 16th, and give us his views on this genetic record, because it's very, very important. The one thing I think is very clear, and that is that whether you're black or whether you're white or whether you're Chinese, everybody on the planet has a common Y chromosome dated back to 50,000 BC. It's very important. We're very recent, very new species, and we're very closely related. And there are reasons for this, I think, which I can come back to later and go into this in more detail. But I think that the geneticists will be able to put many people's mind at rest as to where these people came from, whether we have literally alien blood or not. The as things stand at the moment, we are very unique, we're very new, and we're all very, very similar, and we also have very similar brain sizes. What we do with our brains may be a different matter, but many people now are producing wonderful work in letting children play music at a very early age, letting children do a lot of mathematics at a very early age. And we're finding that we can get terrific performances from individuals if we approach our education in a different way than the one we've done it before.
Yes.
And the other issue is that we, all of us, have these latent practical skills. 100 years ago, we would have been doing twice or three times the amount of physical work we do now. And we would have been far more practical people, fending for ourselves, feeding our families, making our own homes, doing all kind of things, which were quite different to being put in a more sort of urban box, as people are now, expected to perform in a particular way. And this is giving society a whole range of very serious and difficult problems. And this is one of the major areas I think that we can look at and compare with our ancestors, who recognized that we needed a role society. We needed to be able to train people to do specific jobs and train them very well. So if we take the city of Mari, which was a very good example of one of the great early cities before 2500, there were over 200 trade guilds, with people being craftsmen in each of those 200 trade guilds. We see the tradition still surviving amongst the Druids of people having to spend 20 years of training before they become a master craftsman or reaching certain qualifications. Mm. So that every member of the community, the administrators, the policymakers, the leaders, were all extremely well equipped and extremely well trained to look after the community as a whole.
And this was a necessity for survival, correct?
Exactly. If you can imagine what it would have been like for you and I back at that time, and we'd been one of the seven, and we'd been looking at a world completely crumpled and buckled, damaged, and everything lost, we would have had to say, how the heck do we get everything straight?
Yeah.
And you have the story of and Enil, and Ninkarsag, and Enki, and the other archangels, and the angels, and the watchers. The watchers were the third order of craftsmen, and they were represented on the Anunnaki or Anunnaki Council. O'Brien prefers the word Anunnaki, mm-hmm, as a correct translation of that, but it matters little either way. But what we have is very clearly three layers: the archangels were the two-eyed serpents, because serpent had nothing to do with snakes whatsoever then. It meant wise person.
Right.
And the archangels were two-eyed serpents. The angels were one-eyed serpents. In other words, if you had two eyes open, then you were actually intelligent and doing your job well, and you were less well qualified if you were a one-eyed serpent. And if you were a watcher, then you were also on the same kind of regulatory system, keeping your eyes open.
Do you think it's as simple as that? Do you think that this was a literal, you know, a literal thing, or was this just a symbolic way of relaying this kind of, you know, information? What do you think?
These are the words that come down to us, and the Druids would always say, "We are the Druids. We are the serpents." And the word serpent, the roots, O'Brien goes into great detail with the roots of these key words and shows that all the basic roots, SRP and SRB, the two or three roots here, the basic word of serpent, they all relate to surveyors and medical qualifications and skills, and people who are wise and sensible and extremely well qualified.
Yes.
It's only much later that the word serpent is turned into one of the words for snake. And that is a denigration of the old order, and it's quite a recent denigration.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have is a whole load of snake or serpent cults springing up, which are there simply to tell everybody that the old order, our wonderful ancestors, were awful people. And so we get a great conspiracy theory, and unfortunately, this seems to proliferate in so many different areas.
Well,
that's my view. It's other people to make up their own minds. But you
yes.
can understand, even if you look at children and children's interpretation of our Bible over a very short time span, there were a lovely story of children were asked about various things on the Bible, and one said that the epistles were the wives of the apostles. One child said that Mary had an immaculate contraption, and another child said that Lot's wife was a pillar of salt by day and a ball of fire by night.
That's wonderful.
That just illustrates very simply how we have misused and misunderstood our language. And over my lifetime, so many words come through, and I come right back to O'Brien again. O'Brien uses the word alien, but he's talking about people moving into an area which they didn't exist in before. We use this word for animals, and it only became a word used for extraterrestrials when we began to get all the B movies in the States, and it was much easier to use a word alien than it was to use extraterrestrial. So
yes.
The whole use of the word alien is misunderstood by people today, because it was never intended to mean extraterrestrials.
Interesting. We, of course, you know, can mention at this point also the influence of the Bible in this case here, then, because you know, this is a conflicting story. Obviously, the way the Bible interprets this is that these guys were, you know, evil. This is the snake that's associated with everything from Lucifer to Satan and you know, the devil and all that stuff. And this has been, you know, put forward in this way. But what you're you know, laying forth here is that this is a branch of highly intelligent, wise people who were trying to recreate order in society. And we, of course, later on can tie this together also with the Garden of Eden, because there's obviously a very interesting connection here. But the influence of the Bible, just a short, short note on that. Do you think that that has been helpful, so to speak, in discrediting this story?
No, it's been absolutely awful. I recently read a book called The Parthenon and Code, and this is about the wonderful sculptures around the Acropolis in Athens. And Acropolis, on top of the Acropolis, you have the Parthenon built, and it was blown up by accident when the Turks were fighting somebody in that area. But the Greeks were in absolutely no doubt whatsoever that their gods were ancestors, real people, no doubt whatsoever.
Mm.
And they also knew that the serpent knowledge and the serpent system was benevolent, marvelous, good, important, in direct conflict to the Hebrew view of things.
Mm.
So it's very important to look at this big picture. We have a denigration of the old gods, which is very sad. The lady Ninkarsag, for example, who is a single lady in the group who is married to Enlil and is the biologist who works with Enki in the lab and creates so many of our domesticated crops and animals, and also there is clearly the creation of man with advanced technology. And when we begin to look at the advanced technology, which we now know was used on our domesticated crops, which are quite different from our wild crops, and
yes,
there was a one-stage process, and anybody who understands the science will have very little doubt that extraordinary skills were produced in creating something like 40, maybe 50 crops, and the technology being available in southern Lebanon at the start, and then eventually we find the same technology being used at much higher altitudes in South America and Mexico for different types of crops, which were ideally suited to those higher elevations.
Yes.
And so the agricultural record, the sophistication of irrigation, the use of terraces, the use of many different ways to conserve water extremely efficiently, all the things we need to be thinking about now is how we're going to feed the planet. All these technologies were there right from the start. And we find the terraces in Lebanon from the earliest times, the same in Peru, and there was a worldwide common knowledge and technology. And everybody will tell you that it arrived and was taken by the teachers and craftsmen who had come from the Lebanon. That's our starting point.
Yeah, I definitely want to get into a little bit later here much more about the farming, the origins of agriculture. The thing about the seeds is a fascinating story, and this is another scientific proof, if you will, that there is some kind of involvement here, some kind of genetic tampering going on here. But let's talk about the human being before we go in and talk about the agricultural. We have these people then, the Anunnaki. They might have been giants that lived on the earth before the catastrophe. They had knowledge that the catastrophe was coming and consequently were able to prepare in the best way they could. A few survived, but the question arises then, when did modern man, so to speak, pop up on the scene?
Well, I don't think there's any real difference between modern man and these people. As I say, we've got a common Y chromosome at 50,000 BC. I personally think that they had developed their own culture and life to very high standards. They had wonderful diets. They understood the dietary importances. They had been able to do what we can now do, which is extend lives by 50, 60 years, maybe a lot longer. And they also, I think, knew how to use their brains, and they had accumulated a tremendous amount of knowledge. And we see that their whole system within the city-states, with their trade guilds and with their taking enormous trouble to produce carpenters, masons, farmers, stockkeepers, shepherds, all the various trades and professions running up to 200, say, it was crucial that people kept that in the family. There were limitations on people marrying out of their crafts and trades. So fathers would pass knowledge from fathers to son. And the Masons is a very good example, because the Masons clearly kept an extraordinary amount of high technology within their craft guilds.
Mm.
And we see that surviving right the way through to the building of the great cathedrals by the church in the 11th, 12th, 13th century. And we see all sorts of interesting technical things, which like light amplifying glass and these great stained glass windows at Chartres, for example, and a whole range of knowledge which just comes out of nowhere but must have been maintained within the Mason profession. And the Masons were interesting because if you had these later, total disruption later of society and wars, which didn't appear in the early days, in the Golden Age up to the what I call the collapse or destruction of the Bronze Age societies, around about 2354, which is the tree ring date for this next big catastrophe, which destroyed the Bronze Age civilizations and disrupted society. We know right the way from the Mediterranean right to China. But the Masons survived. And, of course, when they were fighting over resources, the kings who had armies or groups of people who had armies, the last people they wanted to kill were the Masons or any good craftsmen. They would round up all the craftsmen and take them with them to build anew. And so some professions did very well out of that because they you're a bit of a fool if you kill all the Masons and you can't build yourself a decent home.
Right, right.
So you see the basic principle I'm talking about. So my view is that we didn't have priests, we didn't have politicians, we didn't have people waving spears at each other within the community, that the community worked incredibly well within the city-state system. And the city-state system lasted literally from Jericho, which is 9,000 BC, right the way through to the great cities in the Mesopotamian plains and many other parts of the world, right up to this catastrophe at 2,356. And so that was the Golden Age. There was very little fighting. We don't find fighting and problems in Britain in our early history from 4,000 BC. We find people coming in as colonizing Britain and farming in Britain and doing all the things they did well in Britain. We don't see any real evidence of fighting until the Roman Empire is formed in about 700 BC. And everything begins to really break down in our sort of western region, so to speak, of Europe.
Right, right. Just backtracking a little bit more and just clarify a few things there. I mean, there were so few, humans or Anunnaki then, you know, that were left at this point back then. They must have done something. And I guess that this would, you know, we can take into account here potentially genetic tampering or manipulation or some way a technology that will enable them to reproduce faster, right? Because if there's only seven left, how the heck do they, you know, multiply? Well, is this an issue here?
Yeah, the interesting point is that there were 200 arrived in the days of Jared, and the days of Jared Jared actually means, I think, descent rather than a name. And so we do have reinforcements arriving, and we don't know where those reinforcements have arrived from, which is another interesting point for further research. So they were backed up by 200 watchers, which was a key point here, but they still were very short of human labor because an awful lot of jobs had to be done. And part of the Karsag epics, which is this key document within the Genius of the Few, we find that they were digging a massive watercourse, which was allowing all the storm water to be fed into the Wadi Nirab in this Rakaya Basin in southern Lebanon. And you can see the great watercourse or the great river out of Eden on the Google images, which you'll find on the Golden Age Project website. And there are many references there to the extraordinary amount of work that had to be done to build the dam, the reservoir, the buildings, and in particular this great watercourse. And it's there. It's a massive watercourse which would have taken all the surplus water from the reservoir, which was collecting water from the flanks of Mount Hermon, and would have drained surplus water into the Wadi Nirab, which would have left the Rakaya Basin dry for farming.
Yes.
And
yes.
Then in the summer months, we know that the winters there was precipitation and enough water, but we know that they would have had to irrigate the crops in the summer months. And so that same great watercourse was the river going out of Eden, but it was a river that was going into four irrigation channels, not other rivers. So the whole story of four rivers in Eden is nonsense. Who ever heard of a garden or an area where people grew crops which actually had four rivers? We're talking here about a mistranslation of the river concept into irrigation channels from a great watercourse, and the sluices are also referred to. So we had a system here of a reservoir which produced water for irrigation in the summer months, distributed by the great watercourse and the sluices and the irrigation channels. And all this required people to build it. And we have within the records the building of knowledge, and Enki and Ninkarsag involved in in vitro fertilization and producing pairs of twins, etc. And we have
what we would do today. We would in vitro fertilization, very straightforward. They'd use their own sperm, and we have this concept of their particular sperm being mixed with local women, perhaps, who weren't direct. Well, they may well have been related, but not directly related to them. But I would have thought that though we could describe them as exactly the same species. There were problems and complications which might give us clues that they were different, but I think that it's safer to assume that they weren't very different from us in their physical, all their physical attributes. They were emotional, they were interesting in all sorts of ways, and so much of these personal details come out within the records, which O'Brien has shown very clearly, and provides us with a marvelous story of benevolent people, above all benevolent people, who were building, rebuilding world for us. And I believe they did a fantastic job, and we have to learn every little thing we can about what they did and why.
This will get us into here in the next segment, as we're going to begin to round things up here for this segment. We're going to get into then a little bit more about this restart of civilization. We're going to get into more about the farming, the different seeds. I also want to ask you a little bit about if there was any difference in intelligence, so to speak, between these species, sort of, or you know, the, you said that they were the same, but yet that there is potentially a difference between them in regards to intelligence, that they might have been blocked in some way or so forth. But for this segment here, let's begin to wrap things up, Edmund. And I do want to mention, though, a few things. I want to mention website again, of course. And also I want to mention the book Genius of the Few. This is by Christian O'Brien, and this is available from Edmund's website, goldenageproject.org.uk. And just briefly, tell us a little bit about the book. And I guess that this is mainly material that we have been talking about today that is in this book. Is that correct, Edmund?
Yes, I've had people come into me and describe it as the new Bible. And the reason for that is because it is a wonderfully prepared document with a tremendous amount of information. It's got an alternative translation of the Genesis text, which shows which words have to be changed, how we are looking at a story of down-to-earth farmers, if you like, in the Hashemim, which means planted highlands in O'Brien's translation, which makes tremendous sense, Shem being the root in there, which is seed. And he goes through all the details in a language that people can understand. And we have a wonderful story in my mind of what our ancestors did, how they provided for us. There are three main segments. This alternative translation of the Genesis text, which is about the bright ones or the shining ones in the planted highlands. It also looks at all the various versions of the books of Enoch or various collections of documents. And Enoch is a Hebrew word, we believe, for Hermes or Thoth. We're not really sure, but that's a clue. And these books of Enoch are a collection of very early documents, which were put together extremely well by the Reverend Charles in the 1890s. And O'Brien takes those as his main source. And we find that when they're translated by a practical person, we're talking about angels going off and measuring and surveying and observing stars and involved with rain gauges and sluices and watering the garden, all these practical things that wouldn't have been translated in that way even 100 years ago. And so that's a key point. And then, of course, the icing on the cake is a very accurate and detailed record, which I believe we can rely on because the Sumerians had an incredible track record of being precisely accurate on everything they recorded. It was part of their disciplines. And there were a few documents. 90% of their work was in recording transactions. But where they repeatedly copied their most important documents, they had to be copied exactly the same with every generation. And I think that the Karsag epics, the 12 key tablets here, are absolutely crucial to the story because they do lay everything out so clearly. And then you have three totally independent sources, the Hebraic records, the Enochian records, and the Sumerian records. And when you have three totally independent sources agreeing on the same thing, then there is a great deal that one can rely on.
Yes.
And I think if you look at the Vedic material, the Greek material, other material around the world, it all makes tremendous sense. And so that is a definitive book. It's also got a translation of the Phaistos disc, which is in the original, very early picture language, which I talked about before, called Emi-An. And the universal measuring rod, a standard unit of measure, being used from those earliest times, which is another very important subject. And a great deal. It's a tremendous amount of information into one book. And I would suggest that people take that book before any of the others. And when they've read it five times, six times, as I've had to do, then they can start thinking about the big book, which is The Shining Ones.
Yes, yes.
Where we can follow the trail of these people and their traditions all around the world, and look a little bit more at this whole business of an intelligent and responsive universe, in that we do live in an intelligent, responsive universe.
Yes.
All manner of things around us are intelligent and responsive. We're only just beginning to learn about that and how to plug into it. And that's a whole new science for many people, and perhaps the most exciting science we have at the moment.
Indeed. The book again is called Genius of the Few, and this is available on the website. Give us the URL again, Edmund.
Yes, Golden Age Project, all one word, lowercase, .org.uk. Have a look. We get a million hits a month and growing, and 10,000 new visitors a month now. And make the most of it and have a look and feedback. We're a network. We want to work with everybody we can. And so just have a look at it, enjoy it, see what you want to see, and tell us what you think. And any bright ideas, we're always keen to have them.
Sounds very good. GoldenAgeProject.org.uk. Check it out. Thanks for this segment, Edmund. Stay with us. We'll take a short break right here, and we'll be right back. Our second segment with Edmund Marriage is available in our members section. If you're not a member and want to continue listening, simply go to our website, redicecreations.com, click on subscribe, and follow the simple instructions on how to sign up and tune in. You'll get instant access to the members area that is filled with radio programs, extended interviews, video interviews from Beyond Knowledge Conference with Ralph Ellis, David Hatcher Childress, Jerry Smith, Ken Thomas, and Marcus Allen. We also have our first short film and our first live broadcast archived there for you. We also have articles, and soon we're going to start up our regular live programs with live video and audio feeds from our studio. More like a TV broadcast, so heads up on that. That's very exciting. Also, stop by our forum, rediceforum.com. Share your findings, recent articles or video, or discuss the latest program. Thank you for listening, and thanks to producer Fredrik Palmgren. We'll be right back with more Edmund Marriage after this break.
Put your hands on the wheel, let the golden age begin. The window down, feel the moonlight on your skin. Desert wind, cool your aching head. The weight of the world drift away instead. Still I all night.